It's my pleasure to welcome you to the last event of today's Einstein Fest proceedings, our Sunday Bistro Banter, American Express Bistro Banter. And I would like to once again acknowledge the president of American Express Canada, Beth Horowitz, who's right here in the audience. This afternoon's program will be very similar to last Sunday's, and I'm sure all of you were here last Sunday as well. And that was very informal, and I will start off by asking various questions to our honored guests, whom I will introduce in a moment. And there will be lively and informal bantering between the guests and myself and between the guests and themselves, whereupon, after half an hour or so, I will open up the floor to questions from all of you, and we will have a Q&A session, and it will end roughly in an hour or so at 5 o'clock, although we will all be here to talk even more informally, the informal part of the proceedings, to have casual conversation and discussion with you. And I want to mention one other thing, and that is that, as you may have noticed, there is full bar service and some food service that is here. So this is not only part of Perimeter Institute's ongoing commitment to providing high quality programming for the community at large, it's also our way of generating income. So please drink as much as you possibly can, eat as much as you possibly can, and I can assure you that the conversation becomes much wittier the more that you drink. So
thanks, Howard.
Yeah.
I was really concerned. I thought this was the karaoke part of the evening.
So let me now take some time and introduce, in keeping with the informal nature of this, very, very briefly, the individuals who are participating in this Sunday's Bistro Banter. To my far right, I have Jim Delgado, who is the Executive Director of the Vancouver Maritime Museum and who gave such a stimulating talk earlier today on Arctic exploration. To my immediate right, I have Robert Friedel, who is a historian of science and technology at University of Maryland, College Park, and who gave, as you may have seen, two very good talks, one at 10 o'clock this morning on the history of science and technology in 1905, and one just recently with Mike about the history of wireless. To my left, I have Mike Lazaridis, the co-CEO of Research in Motion, and many of you know, of course, as the founder of Perimeter Institute, as well as the Institute for Quantum Computing, who participated in the very engaging and farsighted, if somewhat a little bit off topic at times, talk this afternoon.
I can see where this is going.
It was we were told it was going to be a wireless talk, but it certainly incorporated wireless communication. And Mike Lazaridis. So please give a warm welcome to all three of our guests. And before I start off with some specific questions to some of our speakers, I'd like to reiterate something that I said to Mike as we were sitting down, which is, it's nice to see so many friendly faces, but to some extent we're always a little bit concerned that we're preaching to the converted here. So don't hesitate when it's the question and answer period to come up with the toughest questions you can possibly imagine to our three speakers. I'm sure they would appreciate
Thanks, Howard.
I'm sure they would appreciate that very much. So
let's can't throw anything though. Just questions.
As long as you order it, you can throw it. So let me start off asking you, Robert, a question. With respect to the times in 1905, as you spoke, it became very clear to me that it was a time really of absolutely transformative change. From wireless communications to the horseless carriage, as you said, to airplanes and the Wright brothers, it was an age when so much technology seemed to be coming together in such different ways at such a relatively short period of time. And in this day and age, we're constantly told we're being bombarded by the media, oh, this is an age of incredible technological change and fast-moving change, and your grandparents won't be able to operate a computer, and everybody's being left behind, and only the kids today will be able to move forwards. But it's not entirely clear to me that that's true. And if you were to give your objective assessment as to what age represented a greater amount of technological change and a greater amount of rapidity of technological change, would you say that 1905 was greater than 2005, or would you say the opposite, or how would you address that?
Do I get another option?
You get as many options as you want.
Actually, this is my students know that this is one of my shticks, that we are in fact bombarded by this image of ever more rapid, accelerating technological change. Oh my gosh, you're getting faster and faster and faster. But my favorite period for this sort of thing is, well, let's put it this way. My belief is that if I had gone to sleep in the year 1830 and had woken up in 1860, that's a space of 30 years, I would have been totally disoriented. That with the period with the railroad was introduced, the telegraph was introduced, photography was introduced, anesthesia was introduced. The list is quite astonishing for, back in the sleepy old 19th century. So in fact, you can look at history and you can see all sorts of the periods of astonishing change. And one of the things that's striking is at least from the early 19th century onward, people began to be much more self-conscious of the periods of change. People in the 1840s, for example, in the 1850s, were as dazzled as anybody else. They could see the changes that were coming around them. And I think that was true for 1900, 1905, just as it had been true for the end of the 20th century. So as I said, if I had to choose a period of neck-snapping change, as a phrase is sometimes used, I would pick that period from, as I said, about 1830 to 1860 would be my top candidate.
Before I move on and ask another question, if any of our other participants have anything they'd like to add, please feel free to jump in. Hearing nothing, I will turn to, despite the fact that I thought it was a particularly good question myself, I'll turn to Jim, to my right. One of the things which I began thinking about as you so eloquently described the age of exploration and the interface between the Western explorers and the Inuit was, and you mentioned how many of the Western explorers and the British explorers, to their peril, did not pay attention to warnings of the Inuit, did not dress like the Inuit, did not learn from the Inuit, and this is part of some hubris, I guess, that one could imagine. I'd like to turn things on their head a little bit and say, as best as you can conjecture, because I know you've been there and I know you've spoken to many people, what were these guys, namely the Inuit, what were they thinking? So here they see these explorers who are coming, and they're trying to get from A to B, and they're dying all over the place, and it's a big mess, and they're being very hospitable, and they're helping them out, and they're assisting them, and sometimes they're saving their lives. Did they, to the best of your abilities, did they have an understanding of what was driving these explorers? Did they think they were all just completely crazy? What was their perception? What do you think, in terms of your best guess, their mindset was?
Well, with apologies to those of you with delicate ears out there, the Inuit, when they first saw these white explorers and watched them, figured, first off, if they weren't crazy, they were probably nothing better than spoiled, disobedient children. And the way they explained this was there's a legend in Inuit cosmology that speaks of the girl of a chief or leader of this community who fell in love with her father's favorite sled dog, slept with this sled dog, and had children. And these half-dog children basically were white people or kabluna. that explanation, they figured they had it. After all, the white people were, one, disobedient, two, clearly didn't understand the way things worked, just as their ancestor had not, and yet were somewhat part of the family, needed to be pitied and helped. That being said, when you come to something like the Franklin Expedition, you have 120-odd white people concentrated in an area of the Arctic, and they're in trouble. They need food. They need clothing to survive. People have said, well, why didn't they just immediately throw away their prejudices, adopt Inuit tradition, and why didn't the Inuit help them more? Well, the Inuit, in order to survive, needed to, on any given day, the hunter had to roam over 3 to 5 square miles just to get enough food to feed himself and his family. That meant that your average group size was no more than several people. An extended family group is all that basically could survive in that area. Now you've got 120-odd people, and you just don't have enough square footage to find the resources to feed them. To get enough furs to clothe a single individual would take months to hunt, prepare, and make that garment. And so it was far easier, in order to preserve the life of your family and yourself, to step back and watch them thin themselves out. And the evidence suggests that only when it was down to the very end, when you had a handful of survivors left from the Franklin Expedition, did people step in to help them. Because otherwise, what you would end up doing is just committing suicide and kept dooming everybody else that you cared for.
Right. Thank you. Mike, let me turn to you. And I'd also like to know Robert's views on this. So you spoke very passionately and very eloquently about the importance of basic research, the importance of ideas, the connection between fundamental research and its eventual offspring, applied technology. And, of course, that's near and dear to everybody's heart who works here and is part of the message that we're constantly trying to convey about the importance of basic research. And that is unquestioned. These should be unquestioned, although perhaps it's not unquestioned among people who may not be the questioning types, but that's another issue. Let me ask you a question about the personalities of those involved, though, because we all recognize that there is a difference in mindset and mentality in people who do basic research. There is a different orientation intellectually in terms of what gets them out of bed in the morning and what makes them go. Not only what they work on, but how they think. And we've heard examples of this throughout this entire weekend. We've talked about the great minds of the 19th century in terms of physics. This weekend and the past weekend, we heard mention of James Clerk Maxwell. We had heard mention of Kelvin and Lorentz, and leading up to Einstein, the great thinkers who revolutionized our understanding of space and time and electromagnetic theory and so forth. We also heard mention this weekend of people like Thomas Edison, of people like the Wright brothers, of people like Marconi. These are people who were the progenitors of so much transformative technology, and yet they were, all of them, of a different sort of class. They had a different way of looking at the world. They might have even had a different work ethic. What can you say yourself, as somebody with an understanding and a passion for the importance of basic research, but yourself an inventor, can you speak a little bit about what you might consider to be the difference in orientation or the difference in mindset between people who are devoted towards unlocking those ideas and building technology, as opposed to the people who are actually thinking about the ideas qua ideas themselves and the high-level theory?
All right, so is this my exam? Is that it? I got to write my thesis now.
42, I think it is.
So here we go. The fundamental thing, I think that we have to go back and realize that there's something that separates us from everything else. As human, you know, what is it that's important about humans? And this can be fairly controversial if you start thinking about it, because quite frankly, a lot of what we do is mirrored by animals, right? We very similar things. But there is one thing that seems to set us apart, and that's our curiosity and inventiveness. And you know, I think that curiosity and inventiveness goes hand in hand. And it's just different in its expression. But I think it's all the same thing. So a
scientist who's looking at basic theory, they have learned, they spent their time learning the tools for discovery and understanding and a language to describe reality and describe physical phenomena. And that's most often math and logic. And they use that to try and understand physical reality deeper. And this is one of the trickiest things, because a lot of the physical reality that science is understanding and disclosing to us, we can't see, feel, or touch. It's something that's beyond our senses, and it's all through indirection, and it's all through amplification of phenomena through technology. There's a whole spectrum, because you've got their lab technicians and you've got the people helping them out. There's people doing experiment and they're testing phenomena and they find new phenomena, or they're testing theory and seeing just how precise, how accurate is that theory. And then there's the inventors, the entrepreneurs, the ones that are driven by the curiosity to invent and to produce products. But they're driven by the fact that they want to produce something. There's a interesting comment in the movie Robots, which my kids are watching now.
Not right now.
See and eat, fill and eat. So the great robot, Mr. Bigweld, goes and he says that, his big slogan is, see a need, fill a need. Well, the entrepreneurs see a need, they fill a need by making life better for their fellow citizens. Scientists see a need to explain a phenomena, to discover something new. And they fill that need using their ingenuity and the tools that they've learned through university and through school, which is the mathematics. And then the lab technicians, sort of in the middle, they're the ones that are trying to, to refine the experiment and to test the theory. And they're trying to discover the technology, which is produced by the entrepreneurs. Because, if the entrepreneurs didn't see the need for a computer in the general public, the computers wouldn't have been available. We wouldn't have these calculating machines, which are then used by the lab technicians to produce their experiments and so forth. So there's that connection, that theme between technology and basic science. But what really is going on is curiosity and inventiveness.
And maybe I want to ask you, Robert, something along these lines, but a little bit more specific. It struck me when I was listening to this afternoon's talks and yesterday's talks that the people who really were the ones who were, yes, they were absolutely, as Mike said, driven by curiosity, but the ones who were really pushing us over the edge, the Wright brothers, the Edisons, the Marconis, these were not people who were in the standard academic tradition. These were not people who were overall driven by mathematical elegance or mathematical simplicity. There is no doubt that the ideas that Mike refers to certainly played a formative role in the development of the technologies of and in turn of the times. But it seems almost, at least it seemed to me, as if there were almost two classes of people. And it seemed curious that these people who were the ones who actually had so much impact and did so much in terms of moving forwards. And Peter Jacob gave such a great talk about the Wright brothers and showed that not only did they come up with the airplane, but they actually came up with all sorts of methodologies about how to test, how to build, how to think scientifically, how to engineer. And I guess what struck me is maybe it's the fact that they didn't come from the standard academic mainstream that gave them some insight or some ability to change things. So I get my question, and perhaps a more refined question to you without any examination whatsoever, is that maybe there are, in this particular case, two types of people or two types of curiosity which are mutually reinforcing and mutually necessary but certainly distinct. Is that a fair justification, or is that a fair categorization, or is that just arbitrary and incorrect?
Yes. Yeah. Oh, you wanted to do that.
The answer is 42.
I'm reminded of a quotation which I wish I could remember accurately, from none other than our hero of the year, Einstein. But I believe the quotation, and somebody please correct me if I'm wrong, it goes somewhat like, imagination is more important than knowledge. And I think what you're really touching on here is the fact that imagination takes all sorts of forms, and all of us know that. We all exercise imagination. We watch children and we marvel at their capacity for imagination, and sometimes we get a little sad when we see those capacity for imagination diminishing as they mature. But it's the capacity for imagination that I think that characterizes all of these people. A word that I kept waiting for Mike to use, no reason why he necessarily used it, but it's one that I've latched on for this purpose, is creativity. Because that's really what brings them all together. It's the artist, the scientist, the engineers, the inventors. But just as suggested by that list of individuals, and I could have gone on, I could have included the chefs, the architects, and the like, imagination takes all sorts of forms, and creativity takes all sorts of forms, and it expresses itself in a wonderful, wonderful variety of ways. So, yes, the imagination and the creativity of the scientists that are exploring nature is different in its manifestation from that of the inventors, from that of the explorers, and the like. But it's still imagination and creativity. And I said the variety. The reason I answered you the way I did, besides I wanted to do it, that's right. But also it's because it's not just two types. There is a wonderful variety of types. And what we're seeing in the inventors and what we're seeing in the scientists are just wonderful and splendid manifestations.
If I could just, is this the banter part now? The formal thing's gone, right? We're into the banter now.
We're still in the formal informal.
Formal banter mode. Is that?
Yeah,
so, so you brought up a really good point, and this is the key thing, is that we seem to be born inquisitive and creative. You know, children are just naturally creative. And like you said, as time goes on and they learn knowledge, they start to replace knowledge from creativity. But the key thing here, and this is what you talked about with the inventors, and this is the thing that really, you know, is the heart of the matter. There is a tremendous amount of creative energy in humanity. I mean, we're always creating, thinking up new ideas, dreaming, having visions. But the ability to transform that vision or creativity into something tangible is something that is a skill. And that's where the science part enters in. Because what you talked about with the Wright brothers, what they did, they invented the wind tunnel. I mean, they invented the tools that they needed to perfect their understanding of physical reality so they could optimize their designs and make sure they worked. You know, they didn't go full-heartedly taking, you know, fabricated wings and jumping off of cliffs like a lot of the people
that
before
did,
them.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, those people were driven by the same dream, to fly. They were driven by the same belief that man can overcome gravity and fly. But, you know, they didn't really put two and two together and realize, well, if it doesn't work, I'll die. Right? So they had a little too much faith in their dream. And then they didn't have the tools, or at least didn't put the value in the tools to provide the information they need to perfect the technology so they don't die. This is a recurring theme. I think you and I talk about this all the time.
Yeah, well, I do think, though, there's something else there, and there's if there are two types of people, there are those who are satisfied and there are those who are dissatisfied. And by that, what I mean is, there are some people who just become complacent, and we all know about complacency. Many of us fall victim to it from time to time. Some of us live a life of complacency. You get to a stage where you accept knowledge, and knowledge is basically consensus. And when you accept that knowledge and you become complacent with that, you have this nice, comfortable life, and you move this way, and there are the usual bumps, but it moves on. There are these other types of people, though, who are dissatisfied. They don't want to accept the status quo. They don't want to accept that answer. They don't want to be complacent. And they are the people who become the visionaries, I think, if you will. They're the ones who decide to look over that next horizon and what's beyond that hill. They're the ones who want to dig into this matter of quantum physics. They're the ones who want to try this different style of music, paint this different way, dress this different way. No matter how you slice it, those people set themselves apart from the rest of humanity by questing in that direction. And then, just to wrap it, the rest of people sometimes look at that and say, and there is some level of discomfort. Going back to the question you were asked earlier today, when did people start finding the inherent problems in technology or looking at the risk or the fear factor with it? It goes way back. We might recall a fellow named Prometheus, who gave humanity the gift of fire and was forever tormented because of this. And that Promethean aspect, particularly as a counterbalance to scientific endeavor, has been with us ever since. 1818, Mary Wollstonecraft, Shelley, Frankenstein. Again, it, you know, epitomizes what happens when people step beyond the bounds of their complacency, not for good, but for the peril of us all.
And I'd like to just emphasize that it's something that I thought of when people were describing characteristics, when both Mike and Robert were describing characteristics of innovators. I would go further than complacency because, again, I thought of your lecture, Jim, and I thought of Amundsen, this individual who keeps opening the windows at 2 o'clock in the morning and shivering to steel himself for the possibility of an Arctic exploration years hence. And it's more than, I think, a lack of complacency. There's an enormous amount of determination and stubbornness. When I think of Einstein, and people ask me, because of this festival and because of the year of Einstein, what made Einstein different? Well, that's a hard question to answer, and Einstein was such a transformative intellect that it's so easy to pick all sorts of remarkable things he accomplished. But one of the things that one sees by reading Einstein's papers is the incredible faith and confidence that he had in himself, the incredible resoluteness, his stubbornness, his determination, his will to be able to understand, his will to be able to make sure that things were consistent, his will to be able to break down barriers. And there's this famous, John Rigdon mentioned this last weekend, there's this famous episode when the results of Eddington's 1919 experiment came back to Einstein, and he was in his study, and he had a student by him, and they reported breathlessly, "Professor Einstein, it turns out that your experiment was confirmed." This is the bending of light off the coast of Africa. And general relativity is correct. And the student was flummoxed. She was flabbergasted that he would have been so calm. I mean, here is the validation of the greatest work that this man produced, one of the greatest intellects in the history of mankind, and he took it as if he would take, you know, an order of yesterday's ham sandwich. He the most blasé reaction you could possibly imagine. And she said, "But Professor Einstein, what would you have said if the results would have denied your theory?" And he said, "Well, then I would have felt very sorry for the good Lord, because the theory is correct." And it's that type of stubbornness and that type of resoluteness, I think, that I think cuts across all boundaries, whether one wants to call people inventors or engineers or scientists or explorers, and creates a culture of striving and not accepting anything other than the highest ideals that they are shooting for. So I don't think you can top that. I think you were going to say something, but...
Is that a challenge?
That's a challenge.
That's a challenge. All right. Well, he's right. But it's more than that. It's not just the stubbornness, though. It's this belief that things are discoverable. I mean, it's a stretch. I mean, I don't know how many of you have, you know, tried to understand something, but the belief that you can understand it, that's a stretch. That's having faith in yourself and in the human condition. But there's even more than that, because the one thing that strikes me is we take way too much for granted. Like this whole balance of knowledge versus creativity. We assume, this is what I said before, is that everything, we take it for granted. We live now and go, life couldn't get any better. Right? I mean, got clothes that virtually iron themselves. You know, you get this magic tap, you turn it one way, you get cold water, you turn it the other way, you get hot water, and all you have to do is pay a little bill at the end of the month. We just take everything for granted. And yet, the fact is, we have no idea where we are. We don't. Like, where is all this? You know, what's outside it? And these are the questions that drive scientists, because, you know, they, when you really sit down and understand how little we really know, that's when life gets interesting. I mean, if you're, you know, What's left to explore on this planet, really? I mean, we've explored everything, every mountain, every crevice. They're talking about, you know, there's people out there exploring caves underwater. Probably the most dangerous thing there is next to going for Everest. But, I mean, we're running out of things to explore, and we don't realize that the understanding of where we are and what's going on out there is complete fertile ground. It's brand new. No, we really don't know. We think we know, but we don't.
Well, let me just add, though, because I hear that a lot, being a member of the Explorers Club, and there are some of these folks who do this underwater cave exploration, which is the most dangerous thing, I agree, next to raising teenagers. But I have a number of colleagues who work in the deep ocean. After all these years on this planet, and after 100 years of very detailed oceanography, we still absolutely know nothing about 95% of the ocean. Nothing. Other than the surface of it and currents, we have no idea about what's beneath there or even that seabed. And that's incredible. I mean, for all the people that have orbited this planet, and there are, you know, about 500 of them, there's about 200 people who have been to the very bottom of the ocean. And when you go down there, what you're seeing is a very limited area. The one and only time I got to the bottom, because I am one of those couple hundred, I saw in a day something roughly the size of the Perimeter Institute. And I still don't completely understand everything I saw. Every dive that you make to those kinds of depths, and that was 4 kilometers down, you discover new life forms. And there's all sorts of applications, not just in terms of the biology, but the chemistry, the deep sea geology, all of that, not to mention the incredible record of human history that's down there. There's still so much that we don't know. And for all of that and the need for Earth's exploration, I get completely blown away when I come to a place like this and figure out how much more there is to tap here.
Jim, I think you're right. But the thing is, and I would agree with
hold
you.
Hold on. We're bantering.
Yes. Hold on. So you're talking about, you know, the seafloor, and I agree with you. We know less about the seafloor than we know about the moon.
Yeah.
What's that?
Would you let me finish? This isn't bantering. This is abuse, you know. But here's the point, though, is that we keep forgetting how big the area of exploration is when it comes to ideas and imagination.
Exactly.
Yeah. So I'm sorry if I wasn't bantering correctly, but what I thought you were going to say is that it's interesting that you mentioned 95%. Well, first of all, I wanted to say that I was shocked that there's another Perimeter Institute below the sea, because that's a form of competition, and I think we have to take that into consideration. But
it's the same sort of square meter.
Right, so I understand. But in all seriousness, an interesting point is you mentioned 95%, as we don't know 95%. There's a curious revolution that's happening right now in cosmology, where many people are of the view that we don't understand 95% of the mass energy in the universe, and that everything that's accounted for by the standard model and by our understanding of contemporary physics actually makes up not a good deal more. In fact, some people think a little bit less than 5% of all the mass energy in the universe. And so the issues are that we don't really understand so-called dark energy, and we don't really understand so-called dark matter, which make up that 95%. So many people think that we are at a similar time in terms of what we don't know and our understanding in 2005 as we have been at other formative times in our history.
Indeed, as I tell my 21-year-old, you know nothing. Mark Twain once said that he was horrified at the age of 18 to realize what an ignoramus his father was. 3 years later, when he achieved the age of 21, he was amazed at how much the old man had learned in the last 3 years.
And with that, I think we'll open up the floor to questions. So please raise your hand, this gentleman right in front of me.
One question, it doesn't matter which one you've answered. At what speed is our Earth rotating around the sun that changes seasons?
At what speed? So,
what speed is the planet now?
Rotating
around the sun.
Around the sun. It takes 365 days to go.
Right.
At what speed is it moving at?
Fast enough.
Yes.
Okay, just a couple things. I think it's like 100 miles a second or something.
I don't know. It depends on how big.
100 miles a second? Yeah. But more importantly, it's not the speed that changes the seasons. It's the Earth's tilted. So it's the pole line is tilted.
Degrees.
So depending on which side of the sun it's on, the hemispheres are tilted towards the sun differently.
So and just as a meta comment, I'm happy to take on questions afterwards, more scientifically oriented questions, but that's not really the nature of this particular panel. So it is informal. It's informal and formal. I'm not sure if we're
tough questions,
where
guys.
We are. But yes, let's ask questions. Let's ask questions about the history of science, the history of technology, the impact that technological ideas have had, the mindset, and so forth. There's a gentleman way at the back. So, Robert, the question is, let me ask you first, in your studies, which novels or which works of fiction have been most accurate in their depiction of the times that you're aware of?
That's a fascinating question. And I don't have a very good answer for it. But it does give me an excuse, since we are bantering. Because I was thinking in terms of some of the things that Mike said about the apparent failure of imagination of people at the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century and when I think of novels and it's not the question you're asking, it's the question I wish you had asked, which has to do with who had the most interesting visions. And I was thinking, of course, of Jules Verne, because this is the period of Verne, this is the period of H.G. Wells, this is the period when, in fact, the imaginative novel is, in fact, becoming very important, and it's beginning to attract an enormous amount of attention. Science fiction, as we know it, and that is fiction that truly and intimately wed to science, is... it becomes very real at this point. It's merely anticipated by Shelley and others, but now it's becoming quite real, and it's talking about the future, talking about possibilities, and to me somehow that evokes, at least within the context of what we've been talking about here, those are the books that evoke to me the kind of spirit of the period that we've been thinking about.
Well, I would add to that. When you really get into Verne or H.G. Wells, you discover authors who are far more than classics, illustrated comic books, and I love the Time Machine one down there, though there's not a kick at that, or sort of the standard abridged version we often get with these guys, thanks to Hollywood or Disney in particular. When you look at an H.G. Wells novel like The World Set Free, published in 1910, it's an incredibly brilliant work which prophesies the arrival of nuclear weapons, amongst other things. And it's an often overlooked H.G. Wells book. And when you read all of Jules Verne's 20,000 Leagues, the descriptions are magnificent. And what he's done, which is, to I think, really does herald the beginning of intelligent science fiction, is he's founded his science fiction on science fact. He's really done his homework.
Mike, do you have any science? I will turn back to the audience, but just to pick up on that question, are there any science fiction writers that you think are most prescient or most interesting, resonate? Is there anybody who you would say this is somebody we would pick up on? Is there anybody you'd recommend? Since this is a bantering session, I can just change the question completely and say, Well, perhaps I should ask another question. There's a gentleman over there.
No, he's just Googled it.
Somebody just Googled the actual speed of rotation on their blogger. Beth Harwood from American Express. So, it's 7. You're not going to like the answer. It's 7.27 times 10 to the minus 5 radians per second. So,
the average distance is one astronomical unit.
It basically works out to 1 year.
Talk about the basic research versus the applications, and in my view of it, it seems is that basic research becomes sort of like the, you know, the raw Lego blocks for the fuel that is required for an entrepreneur to be able to stitch, you know, the findings that are made and figure out how to apply those. And I'm just wondering if you agree with that, and further, as we are today, it seems to me from, you know, various blogs and things that I track, it seems a huge amount of basic research that is being done in a lot of exciting areas, you know, nanotechnology, you know, genetics, all these areas, which besides I can sort of see, you know, potential of how it might be applied, but it's happening at such, in what in my opinion is a very fast rate, but hasn't quite caught up to the imagination of entrepreneurs to be able to transform that into applications.
Well, this is a common, this is a ball that Howard and I like to kick around. This is a common misconception, because, you know, and quite frankly, it's something that you know, I've been sort of fighting with this misconception within government, and quite frankly, and also the public. See, the idea is, you don't have some researcher like Einstein out there coming up with, you know, E equals MC squared or general relativity, and all of a sudden the world changes. But what happens is, they come up with this insight basically because experiments going on at that time using the available technology are coming up with unexplained phenomena, unexplained errors in the theory, unexplained events and information. It's the technicians in those labs that are using the latest and most available technology, working with leading companies who provide the tools and the measurement equipment and the oscilloscopes and everything else, to optimize the performance and make it work more sensitive, make it more accurate. It's all this industry that's going on. They call it clusters, right? So you got these clusters around research universities or research buildings. All this process that's going on is constantly being commercialized. So you got the entrepreneurs and the businesses that are going out and commercializing. So, you know, they built this really fancy oscilloscope, this measuring device for frequency. And then what happens is that technology went in there becomes the next generation technology that all the electronics companies buy because they use it. But here's the real fundamental part. That's just going on. That's been always going on. But it's not the discovery that the physicist or the scientist or the biologist or whoever comes up with in his research lab that's driving innovation. It's all the students that go through their labs. It's all the students that are, you know, taught by these researchers, inspired by these researchers, and connected into the scientific framework around the world that, you know, that really inspires and educates these kids, these students, gets them connected into the world scientific movements and what's going on, how to access that information, and then they go out into industry. And it's that effect that's really driving commercialization entrepreneurship. It's these, you know, it's like what happened to me. I got exposed to networks. I got exposed because that was what was called the Watt Land Project, Waterloo Land Project. And then I got exposed to email. And then, you know, it doesn't go away. Like, you don't forget how to use email after you spent 4 years, you know, doing all your assignments on it. And you don't forget about LANs because you worked on the research project. So when you go into industry, you go, well, what's going on? How come no one's using LANs? Right? That was the first thing I discovered. No one had email. I put email on my business card in 1984. I gave it to business people, and they looked at it and said, what's an email? No, really, I mean, this happened. And then they would give me their card, and I would look at it and go, what's a telex? And we finally, 10 years later, converged on something called a fax machine number. Right? But then, you know, 20 years later, everybody's got email addresses on their cards. But it's that's what's really commercializing science, is the students that are going through getting their degrees and their PhDs and masters and postdocs. They're the ones that go out in the industry, and they're the ones that really commercialize everything.
You could still be looking at potentially, you know, an 8 to 10 year cycle from the moment that somebody makes a eureka, let's say, in a lab. By the time the students cycle their way through the education system to get to the industry, and then you put it together with great
machinery. But I'll give you an example. It could be 8 to 10. That's a good cycle. That's a short time. Sometimes it's decades. But what's interesting is, you know, the work that, you know, Einstein came up with the explanation for the photoelectric effect. You saw the experiment here. They had a little zinc plate, and they had the electrostatic meter, and then you had the ultraviolet light knocking electrons out. What you have to appreciate is that they started playing around with this in order to study what Einstein predicted, in order to actually test it. They built these vacuum tubes, and they put a little heating element to boil electrons off, and then they had a plate to have the electrons bounce off. These experiments, people started, there were shops around trying to come up with better tubes for the testing, and then they realized they could control the flow of those electrons by putting another little thing called a grid in front. And then, guess what? Someone after that discovered you could amplify signals with that, and that's how we got vacuum tubes. But they weren't trying to produce a vacuum tube. Einstein came up with the explanation for the photoelectric effect. They weren't trying to build a vacuum tube. They were trying to measure his theory and what it predicted. And then it was all the technicians and engineers trying to help with that experiment that came up with this practical application of the experimental tools that were used.
Okay, another question. Two hands. My goodness. Two hands and an Einstein Fest t-shirt. I have to give it to this gentleman. Okay, so I think there are two questions that you're getting to here. One is the similarities between explorers and innovators, and I think we've talked about that to some extent, but there may be other things that you'd like to add. And the other is, if in fact it makes any sense whatsoever to prejudge or measure the intelligence or the likelihood of an expedition or perchance an explorer him or herself. So maybe Jim.
Well, I think there's a couple things at play here. One is, when you look at explorers, when you look at anybody who's gone out and done something different, and you look at success versus failure, and you move beyond that luck factor, and you look at it really hard, I think there's a couple things that stand out. One is, successful explorers, and I guess most other people, do their homework. They really do their homework. But with that, they don't completely, they don't prejudge. You have some sense, but you sort of leave those perceptions behind in a way, and you become flexible. You become open to other input, other ideas, and to the data that you're collecting when you're out there. Because, a guy like Franklin goes out there, and he has his notion, and he doesn't listen to anybody else. He's made his mind up, and that's the way he goes. Roald Amundsen constantly was getting thoughts and input and looking at the situation and changing. And I think successful inventors and innovators do the same thing. The other thing that I find with all these guys is, as I said in the lecture, you don't do it on your own. You have a leader, you have an innovator, you have somebody that's bright and intelligent, but you're always surrounded by other people who are bright and intelligent, who give you their advice, their thoughts, their criticism. And let's say something for critical thought and for criticism in particular, because it's so absolutely essential. And a strong leader, a good leader, is a leader who accepts criticism. And that's what I think sets some of these guys apart. You could not walk up to Captain Sir John Franklin and criticize him, but you could say that to Roald Amundsen. You could say that with some of these other explorers. And I know a host of these guys who still explore. And the ones who do it are the ones who are the open-minded, let's take the risk, but I'm going to think about it a bit before I jump, and let's get the input kind of guys.
I'm going to go in the audience and ask a question.
No, you can't.
I can't.
Okay. Is there anybody who has a question? Oh yes, this gentleman over here. That's unfortunate, because I was going to ask that very same question to our panelists.
Make a prediction.
Okay, so hold on a sec. I'm supposed to be the chair here. I have a talk, by the way, that I'm giving, so that's the promotional part of Bistro Banter, on October 22nd. So you can ask any hard questions you want to me then. I'm supposed to be the chair here, but I'll answer your question. So let me see if I understand it first before I answer it. So there have been many seminal inventions and accomplishments and so forth. What do I think will be the biggest thing in the next 100 years? Is that it?
I was reading his mind.
Right. Oh, that's impressive. So mind reading probably wouldn't be up there for me, but a lot of people believe in that. So in terms of accomplishments, I will make a distinction. As I think I have a right to do as a responder to the question, I will make a distinction between technology and between ideas, and I will say two things. In terms of technology, I will reinforce what my learned colleague to my left said earlier this afternoon. I think that we will in the next 100 years enter an age of quantum technologies, quantum cryptography, quantum computing, that will change the paradigm, to use a somewhat hackneyed phrase, that we live in. And I think that will really change society. I think the harnessing of quantum theory in its applications and in its technology in the next 100 years will transform society. So that's for those who care about society. For those who care about ideas qua ideas, I also believe that in the next 100 years we will have an understanding, we will have a unification of this chestnut with respect to the reconciliation of quantum theory and gravitational theory. We will have a complete understanding of quantum gravity in the next 100 years, and I think that will be an enormous accomplishment, and I don't even want to speculate on what that's going to look like or where it's going to take us, but I think something of that magnitude will happen. So that's my fearless prediction. However, I think this is a very good opportunity, since we're still bantering, albeit in an informal way, for the next 5 minutes, to deflect that question, having answered it, I hope, to the best of my understanding, my abilities, to my learned colleagues to my right, as well as Mike, to ask him if he has any other further speculations on that. So first, I will ask you, Robert, what do you think will happen in the next 100 years?
Well, I think I may have already said in response to an earlier question today, one of the reasons I'm a historian is that I don't have to answer questions like that. But I am asked that question. I'm not quite sure why. But and just to be a contrarian, okay, I'm really impressed by the capacity. And now maybe I'm talking more about the next 50 years, but the capacity of biology to rewrite all sorts of rules about what it means to be alive, what it means to think, what it means to be conscious. There are some very, very basic questions which I think will have enormous technological implications in terms of the sustaining of life, in terms of understanding and possibly manipulating the way that the brain works and the way the mind works and what it means to think. And I should add, this is not a completely cheery thought on my part, but enormous amounts of effort are being made in all sorts of directions. The ethical questions that are raised are things that we are only beginning now to wrestle with. And so I'm most impressed by that particular direction.
Thank you. Jim?
The bad part about being an archaeologist
taking this big broad view of human history is that I understand that the world works in cycles. And so I say this guardedly, I'm not sure that the next 100 years are going to exactly follow that model of continuing to grow. There may be a period in which we go into somewhat of a dip. And in there will come some inevitable forces that come with that, such as anti-intellectualism. When we see that in this world even now. And there may be other forces at play as well. If I have a prediction, it is that despite that, we will once again, being the organisms that we are, climb out of that and move forward. And this is more of a fervent hope, that in doing so, we continue to build on what we know now. In that, in the future, I think that we will finally achieve a better understanding of the ultimate mystery, which is that enclosed in the cranium. With so much of that mapped but not fully understood, and the capacity of the human brain, I think that that's going to be a key leap forward. I would also hope, too, that that quest to explore continues on. I think that we will find that there is life out there. As to whether or not it's intelligent or not remains to be seen. Indeed, if there is life out there, they may be wondering if there's intelligent life here, for that matter. But I do think when we quest, not only within ourselves, but beyond, I think we will discover that there is far more than just on this globe, and far more than just the ongoing search for minerals or microbes. And in that, I'm not quite sure what I mean by more. I just think that perhaps what we will find is what I said earlier about Arctic exploration. We will truly understand ourselves better the more we challenge ourselves, the more we set goals, the more we push for those things. And finding people that continue to inspire and push us in that next 100 years, I think is going to be paramount.
Thank you, Jim. Mike, I'd like to give you the opportunity to embellish on your earlier comments.
Well, thanks, Howard. I was fortunate enough to be invited to Kyoto a month ago to attend the STS Forum. It's a Science and Technology and Society Forum in Japan. And it was well attended. It was very, very interesting, very provocative. But I had the opportunity to keynote during dinner with someone I met from Europe, a scientist that had been working with it's biological technology. But one of the things he sort of opened my eyes to was something I never really thought about. And it's kind of, you talked about we're going to go through cycles. Well, here's another thing to worry about. So one of the things he said was that we're sequencing viruses. We're using genetic technology to sequence them. So we know what their genetic makeup is. And, of course, what happens in a lab is, well, we take that sequence and we store it on a computer. So we store the sequence for the DNA of some of the worst diseases possible. And we keep sequencing these horrible flu pandemics that we sequence their DNA from samples that we find. And we store them on a computer. Now, that computer is part of a World Wide Web. It gets sent somewhere, it gets saved, it gets archived, it gets forgotten. Now that becomes the ultimate computer virus, if you think about it for a second. It's a biological sequence that has been reduced to a code. The code has been then stored on a computer and forgotten. So even after we get rid of the disease, sometime in the future, someone with their lab kit on, convert DNA sequence from your computer directly to specimens, so they're going to be sitting there with their box. They're going to find this old file somewhere. It's been archived. It's got some bit errors. They decode it. They come up with the original sequence. They don't know what it is. They put it in their machine. They turn it on. Guess what? They get a pandemic. But it's this whole idea that I think the information technology, it's blurring the line between what's biological, what's technology, what's electronic, what's information, what's real, what isn't. I think what we're going to be challenged over the next 100 years is going to be this whole blending of what's information, what's real, what's fact, what's not fact, And, you know, interspersed in that, we've got all these ethical questions as to, you know, should we be storing the sequence for the worst, you know, viruses ever known to man? Because once they're stored on the Internet, there's no way to get rid of them. How would we ever find them?
And on that cheery note, I'd like to bring things to a conclusion. Before I do, I'd like to just add my own 2 cents worth to this discussion, and that is that I think we've all highlighted some issues that are of concern to all of us, and I think we would all recognize that for the future, it is extremely important that we ensure that all of us, society, our policymakers, everybody who has influence, and those of us who live in this society, are as aware as we can be of scientific issues, of their consequences, of the law-like nature of science, and I think that's to all of our interests. And Jim, you mentioned a concern of intellectual limitations and a dumbing down and so forth, and what you were saying. I think we all have to be extremely vigilant to be fighting against that. And I thank you all very much for being here and participating in our little endeavor to ensure that we keep this discussion going as much as possible. Thank you all very much for coming, and thank our speakers very much. Please stay around should you see fit for the informal bantering part of this afternoon. And I'd like to thank our speakers for participating one more time, and thank you all very much. Thank you very much.